Our next speaker is someone we need to be especially nice to. She's the one who will be making sure we get a good deal out of our free trade agreements, which, as you know, are vital to our industry. Ambassador Darcy Vedder is the Chief Agricultural Negotiator in the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative. Previously, Ambassador Vedder served as Deputy Undersecretary for the Farm and Foreign Agricultural Service at USDA, overseeing the agency's international activities. This is her second stint at USTR. From 2001 to 2007, Ambassador Vedder held the posts of Director for Sustainable Development and then Director for Agricultural Affairs. In the latter role, she was responsible for facilitating NAFTA implementation and resolving agricultural trade issues with Canada and Mexico, as well as participating in the World Trade Organization Doha round of negotiations. From there, she moved on to the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance, where she was International Trade Advisor to then-Chairman Max Baucus and other committee members on trade issues relating to agriculture, the environment, and labor, including the 2008 Farm Bill. She joined USDA in 2010. Ambassador Vedder received her Master of Public Affairs degree and a certificate in Science, Technology, and Environmental Policy from the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University, and her undergraduate degree from Drake University here in Des Moines. She grew up in Nebraska on a family farm. Please welcome Ambassador Darcy Vedder.
And for allowing me to be here today. I think, well, first of all, it's nice to be back in Iowa. As was noted, I spent four really wonderful years here as a student at Drake, and so I always love the chance to come back to Iowa. But, you know, I think after those remarks from Governor Branstad, Lieutenant Governor Reynolds, my work here is done. what a great and passionate expression of what trade means to the state of Iowa and how important trade is for U.S. agriculture. And, you know, I was thinking as Governor Branstad was talking about the role of trade and what it means, is that my job is often to think about what trade means on a national scale. What does it mean for farmers across the country? But what it means to many of you is actually very personal. And so I was thinking as I sat there that 70 years ago, my grandfather was fighting World War II in the Pacific and fighting against Japan. And 40 years after that in the 80s, when my own family farm in Nebraska was struggling with that farm crisis, it was our trade with Japan, sending prized soybeans to the Japanese to make tofu, that helped us weather that crisis. And now, in 2015, I have the opportunity to sit down with my Japanese colleagues and negotiate a trade agreement that will bind our economies together into the future. And that's really pretty amazing in the span of just those 70 years. And I think a real demonstration of how interconnected all of our economies really are in this very globalized world we live in. So with that thought, I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about what's on the table? What are we doing in these trade agreements? What does it mean for all of us here as pork producers and just in agriculture generally? And then, frankly, how do we make that happen? How can we ensure that this agreement can be ratified and implemented? And that, of course, requires passage of trade promotion authority, as was clearly noted before. So, with that in mind, let me tell you a little bit about what we're doing here. On the table right now is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, an ambitious trade agreement that comprises 12 countries in the Asia-Pacific region, and frankly, almost done. We've been negotiating this for several years now. We have 40% of the global economy at the table. some of the fastest growing and most dynamic countries in that region have come to the table for us. This is a high standard and ambitious deal. It's not just market access. That's incredibly important, and by market access we mean lowering our tariffs to one another. We're addressing a lot of the non-tariff barriers that can make your job as exporters more difficult as well. Regulatory cooperation, making sure that sanitary and phytosanitary standards, those animal and plant health regulations, are based on science and transparent. Regulating state-owned enterprises that don't compete fairly with our private sector enterprises overseas. Making sure your intellectual property is protected. These agreements cover a range of issues that will really help further integrate our economies and make sure we're all playing by a common set of rules. So, it's critical on a number of fronts here, and we want to move forward. And there are really three reasons why this agreement is so critical. And the slide lays them out nicely. I like to boil it down to its offense, its defense, and its foreign policy. The agreement itself has a lot of economic growth on the table. It's anticipated that $123.5 billion in additional exports every year when this agreement is done. That's a lot. That increases, real income benefits $77 billion per year, 650,000 U.S. jobs. But if we don't do it, others will. We're not alone in this game of creating new trade agreements. Dozens of them are being done in the region alone. And nations are happy to do them without us and to give each other preferential trade access that we won't be able to take part in. But third, this is not just a dynamic region economically. It's a very dynamic region politically as well. I'm sure many of you are watching what's happening in that region politically with China and its neighbors in the South China Sea. We need to be part of that. We need to be forging alliances, and where we have strong economic partnerships, we have strong political partnerships as well. There are key benefits to being part of this trade game that go beyond trade itself. And what does it mean? What do these countries mean to us already? Well, 40% of our U.S. goods and services are going to this region now. 42% of our agricultural exports are going to this region. And 4.1 million jobs already are supported by our trade with these TPP countries. And this is an area of critical growth. 66% of the world's middle class will be in Asia by 2030, which sounds like a long way away, but it's right around the corner. I think the years go faster all the time. And by that same in that same time period, two-thirds of the middle class consumption will be coming out of this region as well. And that's critical for agriculture because when people have extra money, when they enter the middle class, they change the way they eat. And one of the first things they demand is higher quality protein, which means markets for products like pork, for beef, for poultry, for dairy. The demand goes up exponentially in those regions. But also, people start to demand convenience, much as we see in our market. So processed food opportunities. They demand higher quality calories, more vitamins and minerals. Fresh fruits and vegetable exports increase as well. And the United States is particularly well poised to supply that. Not only are we great exporters of the protein itself, our pork, beef, poultry, and dairy, but we export the feed grains that it will take for those countries to build livestock industries of their own. And we have a thriving fresh fruit and vegetable and processed food industry as well. So just to recap here, we're going to eliminate or reduce tariffs on goods to these region, already $63 billion worth of exports that are going there. The largest gains will be in those areas of processed foods, proteins, as we noted before, not only because we see the demand increasing, but because those also tend to be the products where the tariffs are highest. So the relative gain is very important. And we're going to do the same. And that's okay. The U.S. already has one of the most open agricultural markets in the world. But our food processors depend on having access to imported product to be able to blend and make products that also add value to our economy. So this is a reciprocal relationship, and that adds value in the United States as well. And, of course, it will improve transparency and science-based regulation for agriculture. And it's not just those developing economies. It's not just Vietnam and Malaysia where we're going to see demand increase. TPP has the added advantage of having both developed and developing countries at the table at the same time. So while you look at consumers in Vietnam and Malaysia, where demand is rapidly expanding, you also have the opportunity to improve our trading capacity with Japan and Canada, two highly developed and high-value markets. These are countries that have relatively mature markets, but because of their high per capita income, they tend to buy very high-value products from us. And they also, however, come with a lot of red tape. Now, Canada, we have an active Canada, but it didn't open its market to dairy, poultry, and eggs, very important products here in Iowa. And we have an opportunity here through TPP to open that market. The cross-border investment opportunities to be able to integrate our market in these products with Canada is particularly important. Of that new access, the U.S. is poised to get most of it because they're our neighbors. And with Japan, number one export market for pork, almost $2 billion a year, but it is not an easy place to do business. They have complicated tariff regimes. They have tariff rate quotas on a number of products. They have purchasing requirements and state trading enterprises that are difficult to navigate. We have a chance to reduce all of that and to open up the opportunities in Japan. And let's not forget about how much of U.S. farm income really depends on shipping our products overseas. You can see pork down there as relatively small in terms of the percentage of production that is exported. And yet we're talking about $2 million to China alone. Look at tree nuts. Look at wheat, at rice, at soybeans. They're critically dependent on having consistent access to markets. And I think, you know, one of the things Governor Branstad talked about was the introduction of new technologies, the different tools that we use to manage risk and therefore support farmer income. Reliable and open access to foreign markets is one of our most important risk management tools that helps to keep prices stable and to make sure our production gets to those consumers. So we need to keep that moving. And when it comes to agriculture, I noted before that the U.S. market is also relatively open. In general, an ag product that hits our border faces an average tariff that's about 5.3%. In countries like Japan, it's 19%. In Vietnam, over 16%. So when we move together with these countries to bring our tariffs down, the relative gain for U.S. agriculture is bigger, and it's something we need to take advantage of. And when we look at pork specifically, since that's the business all of you are engaged in, $4.7 billion just to the TPP partners alone, 70% of our pork production and exports to the world. And again, Japan, number one export market for U.S. pork and products, $1.9 billion. We think we can increase that number significantly and put more in your pocket for all the volume that you already send by bringing down those barriers. Vietnam, right now at $2.2 million, we think that is going to see an exponential increase, not just because we're going to get rid of those tariffs, not just because you have an increasing middle class, but because of consumer preferences in Vietnam. The Vietnamese diet in many ways mirrors that of China, where we know pork is their meat of choice. It's very much in demand, and we expect to see that grow significantly. And we recently solved SPS barriers to reopen the Malaysian market to pork, and so the TPP access to reduce the tariff barriers at the same time, we think we'll see very significant increases. Now, a lot of the press you've been seeing about the TPP has been focused on Japan. They're sort of the big fish out there. They've been one of the most closed or most difficult to navigate markets in agriculture in the world. But let's remember, despite the fact that it's a difficult place to do business, despite the fact they have layers of barriers, they are our number one market in beef, pork, corn, and wheat. They are already our number two destination for rice and vegetables, three for fruit and wine, four for soybeans, and six for dairy and nuts. So they are a significant partner. But when they do free trade agreements with other countries, they don't tend to put their sensitive products on the table. Everywhere you see an X, if you look at the countries with whom Japan already has free trade agreements, and you look at their most sensitive ag products, everywhere you see an X, they said, we'll do an agreement with you, but these products aren't included, excluded entirely. And everywhere you see some text, those products were included, but in pretty limited quantities. They gave a pork TRQ to the Chileans, but it was a small tariff reduction. They didn't eliminate that tariff, and only for a certain volume of trade. If you look at their deal with Singapore, they eliminated immediately, but Singapore Singapore doesn't produce pork or sugar, so they didn't take much of a risk. But it's the value of the TPP itself, a comprehensive agreement with so many dynamic economies at the table that said, for this one, we're willing to put these products on the table because its value is so high. And now that they've done that work, now that they've worked with their domestic producers, now that they've looked at strategies for how they can open that market, they're not going to wait for us if we don't get the TPP done. They're actively negotiating with the EU. They have agreements in place, as we noted before, with Mexico, with Chile, key competitors when it comes to pork. And they have clauses in those agreements that say they can expand their market access in the future if they want. But they'd rather do it through the TPP. But Prime Minister Abe understands that the Japanese economy has been facing significant difficulties for more than a decade now. And he has made a critical part of his economic reform is the TPP and expanding trade alliances. So if this agreement doesn't go forward, others are ready and waiting to take our place. And just as a case in point, that it's not just Japan who's out there negotiating, but others who are. If you look at 1975, these lines between countries represent trade agreements, regional trade agreements that were in place. So you have the Caribbean countries with a customs alliance. You had agreements among some countries in Africa and Latin America, and you had the EU. But you look at 1995, when we were creating the WTO, and you're looking at many more alliances in Europe and Africa, a few among the countries in Asia. Look at 2014, and look at all those red lines in Asia. Everybody knows that that's a key growth area of the economy, that that's a place where you have to be integrated, and frankly, there's not very many lines coming from the United States. We need to make sure we are integrated into these global alliances. And if we don't, we will lose ground in very tangible ways. And a key way to illustrate that is looking at the beef tariff we face in Japan. 38.5% on fresh and frozen cuts. But in January of this year, Australia and Japan implemented their bilateral free trade agreement. They took their first set of tariff cuts in January. They took their second set of cuts in April. And we'll take another one in April, I believe, of next year. By 2030, if TPP is not in place, Australian beef, our key competitor in the Japanese market, will face half the tariff that we do to Japan. But with TPP in place, we will catch up and go even further. So it's important that we get this deal done and do it quickly, as we're already at a tariff disadvantage with our partners. And it's also important to remember the other big fish in the region is China. And they are actively seeking to strengthen their trade ties with other countries in the region. If you look at Japan, over the last 10 years, trade between Japan and China has increased over 80%, but only 10% with the U.S. Almost 300% increase in the Malaysia-China trade. Less than, around 10% between the U.S. and Malaysia. And more than 1,000% increase in the trade relationship between Vietnam and China in 10 years. And while the U.S. change is quite impressive in this growing market, it's not keeping up with the other major supplier there. And China isn't standing still in doing this. They currently are negotiating 17 agreements themselves, including with 9 of the 11 TPP countries. So we need to stay on a level playing field with them. They have an agreement. We have the TPP. They have the RCEP. It's called the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. We have 40% of the global economy at the table in TPP, 35% with those Asian country partners along the side of that slide there are at the table. What that will mean when they finish RCEP is that China will not face barriers into those countries, but if we don't finish TPP, we will still face the high tariffs into those countries we face today. But importantly, what we think is key about TPP is that it sets new standards for how countries treat each other on things like transparency, intellectual property, creating high standards for labor and environment protection. And those things are not on the table in the RCEP. There are not provisions to protect worker rights, to protect the environment, to promote free and open flow of data, and to establish fair rules for state-owned enterprises. We can set the stage by finishing and implementing TPP quickly and change the way that countries do business in a way that reflects our values and what we think are fair standards for doing business. So, Some of you have heard this presentation before. Some of you have heard me say before, we are in the endgame of the TPP. But I really mean it. We really are in the endgame now. This has taken a while to negotiate, but I just returned from Guam, where we had a meeting of the chief negotiators, about 3 weeks of negotiation. And really critical decisions are being made. Those things that you leave till the end because they're the hardest thing are what's on the table right now. It is our goal to conclude a deal as soon as possible, but it will have to be a deal that works for us economically and reflects our key values for business. We work extremely closely with Congress throughout this process. I spent my entire day yesterday on the Hill consulting with members of Congress about this and then ran to the airport to fly here. So, you know, our negotiators have held literally hundreds of briefings with Congress and with stakeholders like all of you to get good advice about how to move forward. And for us, it will be the substance of the deal that drives the timing, but I can tell you that that's starting to come together now, and we see that concluding in the very near future. But we can't do it without a key piece of legislation being passed by Congress, Trade Promotion Authority. And what TPA does is basically gives me very specific instructions, not for only what I need to achieve in that negotiation, but how I need to then consult with you as producers and stakeholders and with Congress to make sure I'm getting to meeting those objectives in the best way possible. So it sets chief negotiating objectives, giving me key instructions about what I should achieve. It very specifically outlines my requirements for notifying Congress about different steps in the negotiation, consulting with all of you, and making information public as it can be made available. And then, in exchange for following those very specific instructions, it says that Congress is going to consider its vote on this agreement in an up or down fashion. It's not going to try and amend at the end what the tariff phase-out period is for pork or for chicken. It's going to accept that there was a package deal made and vote yes or no. But by the time we get there, if we follow these instructions that Congress gave us, there shouldn't be any surprises. And TPA itself lays out conditions for informing the public, for making sure that for 90 days from the time I shake hands with my partner on the other side of the table until Congress starts considering it, that the agreement is out there for review by Congress and by the public so that everyone is transparent and knows what they're voting on. So a bipartisan TPA bill will guarantee that we are all speaking with one voice to our trading partners and the rest of the world on our values, our priorities, and the substance of a deal. And we need it to move and move quickly. We're very thankful that the Senate has already voted to pass Trade Promotion Authority, and it now sits with the House of Representatives, where we hope it will move in the next couple of weeks. One of the complaints we hear a lot about TPA and the opponents of trade generally, of TPP, have consistently said, why would Congress cede their authority to the President? It's giving up something they should otherwise have. But TPA doesn't really do that. Congress and the President already have joint authority over trade and international agreements. But I can tell you from experience, as an official who used to work at USDA where I ran a number of programs, the level of congressional oversight that I receive on negotiating this agreement is far more extensive than what you see in running a number of other government programs where Congress also has oversight. I'm on the Hill every week, often multiple times, to provide an update on how the negotiations are going, to get advice. I've called some of the people in this room at really odd hours of the night while in Asia to ask their advice about what is the best way to structure this agreement. And so the amount of give and take on shaping this relationship with the TPP is really quite something and has influenced what happens at the table. The other concern is that TPA, Trade Promotion Authority, which is often called Fast Track, it will move so fast that it will stick this agreement in front of Congress and make them say yes or no before they have time to think about it. And that's just not the case. First of all, under TPA, we're consulting throughout the negotiation, so people know what's on the table. But 90 days before the President signs that agreement, he has to notify Congress and start to make that agreement available not only to Congress, but also to the public. And once those negotiations are completed or months later, when the implementing legislation for that agreement is introduced, Congress takes up to 90 days which is 90 legislative days, so 90 days when Congress is in session, so a lot more than just 3 months, to hold hearings, to convene sessions, and before they ultimately vote. So there's plenty of time to make sure we all know what that up or down vote will cover. And this is not new. This is not an exceptional request from President Obama. This trade authority dates back to 1934, when the New Deal, during the New Deal, Congress allowed President Roosevelt to negotiate tariff reductions with other countries to try and stimulate our economy. So this is not an exceptional request. This is a request for an authority held by many presidents for many decades. So the bill contains a number of key measures. You can see them up there on the slide. I won't go through them all extensively, but it sets 21st century negotiating objectives for agriculture, not only to get robust tariff reduction and elimination, but new and enforceable rules on those SPS, those sanitary and phytosanitary measures. So it has increased the level of negotiating objectives for ag, which is great for me. That helps me to have a TPA in place with a strong objective for agriculture so I can say to my trading partners, this is not a nice to have, this is a must have if you're at the table with the United States. My Congress has given me clear instruction. It also requires a number of transparency measures to make sure the public and the Congress has a chance to review. If in fact Congress decides that we haven't met the standards, we haven't met those objectives, we haven't consulted with them appropriately, they can pull back that authority if necessary. That's a new feature in this agreement. And it makes clear that a trade agreement is not a place to look at other U.S. domestic laws. It's not a place to slip in provisions that will change the acts of our Congress. Clearly outlines U.S. sovereignty. And again, it creates advisory groups of stakeholders. It creates advisory groups even within the houses of Congress to make sure we're getting the best advice possible. So again, we got through the Senate. We're waiting on the House. We expect the House to consider that in the next 2 weeks. But we also need them to hear from you, and to hear from you strongly. What's at stake? What are those slides we just went through? What is that relationship with our Asian trading partners that is at risk if we don't first put in place this critical tool to allow us to enact this agreement? And it's clear that from my perspective, sitting as a member of this administration, it is all trade all the time. This is the president's top economic and legislative priority. Every member of the cabinet is actively participating in TPA right now and in the TPP. More than 100 events have been held in 34 states by cabinet members themselves. I personally, since being confirmed in July, have attended over 100 events on the Hill and across the country to get out the message on this. It is our top priority by far. And there's widespread support, as you've just heard, from our state leaders of both parties and at the national level as well. So if you want to learn more and you're willing to get that message out, here are some resources you can go to. Fact sheets that will show the benefits for each state that we anticipate from agricultural trade agreements, TPP specifically, state-by-state fact sheets, and why TPA is an essential tool. I'm leaving this with all of you, so if you you can contact the NPPC folks who will put you in touch with these links. And this is an example of what you'll find. And, of course, I had to pull the Iowa sheet for today, but you can go and find a fact sheet like this. What's at stake for Iowa agriculture? What are key exports? What barriers do we think that we'll be bringing down? And you can use those in your outreach to make the case. So we appreciate your cooperation and ask for your help in making that happen. So with that, I will stop there. Thank you very much. And I think can take a few questions. Is that the plan? Go right ahead.
Darcy, I wonder if you could speak specifically about Vietnam, Japan, and Australia that have been difficult to deal with on some very specific divisions, and where you feel like we are, in particular with those three countries, on making progress.
Sure. Well, again, I think we've made very good progress with all of the TPP countries, and when it comes to market access, which I think is what you're focused on here, we do expect to see major gains for U.S. pork in both Japan and Vietnam. We're seeking, of course, tariff elimination wherever possible, and in Japan, we know that the thing you struggle with is the gate price system. So how can we help to make that system easier to navigate, shall we say less effective, in making sure that you can ship the wide variety of pork products and in more direct relationship with retailers in Japan? And we think we've made very significant progress there. Similarly, with Vietnam, we continue to seek tariff elimination across the range of agricultural products and are working on the exact structure for that. Obviously, these are sensitive negotiations, so I can't get into very specific detail. With Australia, what we're seeking, of course, is to remedy an SPS barrier and to work with them on beginning a new risk assessment based on additional scientific information. The animal health officials in Australia and in the United States recently placed pork on their priority list of issues to address, and we hope that means we'll be seeing a risk assessment conducted very soon.
Darcy, I had the opportunity to ask you this question or a similar question last spring, and since then we've had a couple of trade assistance programs approved for South Africa.
Yeah, another round of AGOA and other trade assistance programs. We still feel that we're really kept out of that market for some trade barriers that aren't legitimate. Our competitors to the north, South America, have easy access into that market, a significant amount of pork. What can we do to give us some assurance that we'll get access into that market?
Look, if this is another situation where animal disease issues are...